Here we are again, everybody. It's the Roll Around the Barrel podcast, 2021 variety. It's time to get back into it. I'm over the holiday depression of the holidays being over. I don't know if anybody else follows that. When my kids were younger, I would get depression after the holidays because you spend all that time into making their Christmas awesome. And then in like 17 minutes, it's over. And then you're like, oh, I got nothing else to do now for 4 months. As the winter, even though here in Michigan, the winter hasn't completely set in yet. It's been unseasonably warm for this time of year. I think we were in the 40s yesterday. All right, on the phone line. Let's get into this interview. Currently in Florida, it's Kevin Irish Doyle. Kevin, how you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
Currently in Florida, because from what I've learned about you in a short amount of time is you've kind of bounced around. So how long do you think you're going to be in Florida?
I've been here 4 years now, and because I retired from full-time work, I'm planning to stay here as my home base.
How do you find the humidity in the summer?
It's definitely brutal, but I spent enough time living in Houston on the Gulf Coast, get acclimated to the Gulf Coast. So we always think of like the summers in the Gulf Coast as like the winters up north, you know, where you stay indoors and you know when to come out, when to stay in, and the Gulf Coast is the same way. You know when to stay in the air conditioning, and then early morning, late at night, when to come outside. So it takes some getting used to.
Oh yeah, Houston. Although I've never been, I know that the summers in Texas are not fun either. But I tell you, the last time I visited the Florida Keys, went for a week, and the last day of that trip, and it was in June, and Florida will never see this lily white bottom in the summertime ever again. That'll never happen.
Yeah,
but
it's rough.
I went in June, and the last day of the trip, it was so bad outside that I just stayed in my hotel room.
Yeah, you gotta be on the beach and in the water almost. If you're going to spend any lengthy time outside, you know, that's probably the most comfortable you can make it.
So before we get into the history of you and baseball, let's get into the history of the Fort Myers, Florida Vagabonds. How long has that club been going on?
We're really newbies. We just started up in 2019. So late summer 2019 is when we formed. So we've really only been at it for about a year, pushing a year and a half.
And how many clubs do you have around to have a season with? There isn't too many, is there?
There's only two. We're the second. The fellas over in Central Florida, they're called the Awkwards. They're from the Orlando, Kissimmee area, and they've been around a while. So we're only the second club in Florida. There may be a third club that was active and is inactive, but at the moment, it's us down here in Fort Myers and the Awkwards up in Central Florida.
So the Awkwards must have been really excited for your club to start.
Those guys have been great. Once I put a Facebook page together and started to put some information out there, once they saw that there was a club, they got really excited, and they've been very supportive, and they're the guys we play in our matches. So they've been great.
When does your season run down there?
We start we start our practice in September when some of that humidity and heat that you talked about backs off a little bit. So we're practicing in September. We had our first match in late October with the Awkwards. And then we try to fit another match in sometime November, December. With the holidays coming, it gets a little complicated, but we would have a match in there. And then January, February, and then March, and then April's probably the end of our season. So say October through April.
So when the season is over and you've completed your 4-month journey, are you ready to enjoy other people playing baseball, like college and the major leagues, or are you guys kind of a little pooped on baseball and it takes a little while to re-energize that passion?
I don't think so. Because I know some clubs, vintage clubs in the United States are so well organized and have so many teams that they can play every weekend. But, you know, we pretty much have probably maximum 2 matches a month. So I don't think we're maxed out just by the number of matches that we can fit in. So come Major League Baseball or in college baseball, I personally am pretty stoked to be watching that. And then this year was crazy. I was watching Korean baseball on ESPN. It was
I think we all hit up the Korean baseball because we just didn't have a choice.
I know. It was great. I didn't have any problem with it at all. It was fun.
So down there in Fort Myers, you have the Mighty Muscles, the Class A affiliate of the Twins. But did they make it through the cuts of them downsizing minor league baseball, or are they still going?
I'm pretty sure they're still going, but I haven't heard any of the details. I've been fishing around for information on all the teams, and I haven't seen any kind of a schedule come out or anything yet. Maybe that's just because of the pandemic, but I'm pretty sure that they made it through. They don't have any specific information.
Yeah, I've gone to the website, and they have no schedule, and they have no mention of
it. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I know all that kind of came out like a bombshell for some of these major league or minor league teams. So, you know, it's a...
Yeah, their latest news was just to announce that they, on December 9th, they were invited to continue as a Twins affiliate. So that's the last mention that they've had on their website. So,
well, that's great. And they have a great ballpark. It's a real user-friendly ballpark, and it's fun to see the Twins when they're in town, and it's fun to see minor league guys through the summer.
How did you come across the name Vagabonds for the Fort Myers club?
Yeah, that's related to Thomas Edison, and then that all feeds into how we got started. The Vagabonds was a nickname that Thomas Edison and Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone gave to each other. They were buddies. Like 1914 through 1925 or so, they got together in the summer and took road trips back when, you know, all there was the Model T Fords. And they started off going out in the Everglades down here together. And then their future trips were mostly up north and New York State and probably out your way into Michigan. So they called themselves the Vagabonds. And we chose that name because I got interested in vintage baseball through the little one-day baseball festival that's sponsored by the Edison Ford Winter Estate. So Thomas Edison came down to Fort Myers for his summer vacation back, you know, in that time period, the early decades of the 20th century. So, and Fort Myers there wasn't much to Fort Myers at the time. So for him to come this far south and built a home and whatnot. And eventually Ford, they were buddies. Ford came down and bought the house next to him. So the Edison Ford Winter Estates is owned by the city of Fort Myers, and they maintain it. And it's a beautiful property, and you can tour it, and they've got the gardens and everything still maintained. And they sponsor every year for maybe the last 5 years a one-day vintage baseball festival. And that's, I attended that. My wife and I attended that in March of 2019. And that's where we were like, wow, this is really cool. We should do this. And so I got in contact with the Edison Ford Winter States, and the fellow who organizes it, he was all for trying to get a team going. So kind of an honor of Edison Ford Winter States and, you know, what they've done for vintage baseball down here. That's where the name came from. So the Vagabonds.
Yeah, that's great. Up here in Michigan, the center of our vintage baseball universe is the Henry Ford Museum. And I believe they have the Thomas Edison Workshop on the grounds.
Exactly.
And I think we have Thomas Edison's last breath in a test tube somewhere. So.
Oh geez, yeah, it's quite a story. I remember they tell you that at the museum that once Edison was going to build some more elaborate laboratories, Ford snatched it up and said, "Can I take this to up north?" And so that's very interesting.
You sound like you know a lot about Thomas Edison. Tell me something that I don't know about Thomas Edison, which it shouldn't be hard.
Well, for as brilliant he was as an inventor, I mean, he probably wasn't as brilliant as a businessman. You know, he didn't take advice. Like some folks would say, well, that's a great idea, but I don't think it's going to fly commercially. You know, there's not the demand for it or the need for it. And he'd press on with a lot of his ideas, and, you know, he wouldn't make, let's say, as much money perhaps as, you know, if he'd taken some of that advice. So he was a great inventor. He stumbled a lot in some of the business side of what he did. And then he was also deaf. And so it's amazing to see how he functioned, you know, with guests come into his home and how he communicated with his wife and everything. He had like a system of taps, almost like a Morse code type thing that him and his wife had worked out. And yet, you know, he was fully functional as a scientist and inventor. And it's just amazing he had that extra challenge that he had to deal with, that he did so very successfully. So.
Yes, I did not know that. 17 points awarded to you. Kevin, let's go back to the beginnings of you as a child, whenever it is that baseball enters your life. But, hey, does everybody say O'Doyle rules to you? O'Doyle rules. You ever get that from the Adam Sandler movies?
No, I haven't.
Well, you will now. O'Doyle rules. And you're not an O'Doyle, you're just a Doyle, but you're Irish, so close enough.
Yeah. Got dropped. Okay.
So when do you first encounter baseball in your life?
Probably in the 70s. My dad used to take me up to Connemack Stadium, the old Connemack Stadium, and to the Phillies. We'd go up there for games. And then that stadium was replaced by the more modern veteran stadium. So I used to go to the games with my dad, and then his company that he worked for would run. They had like an athletic club. They'd run a bus from Philly up to the games, and you get a hoagie and get to the game, and it was a lot of fun. So that would be my first exposure to baseball. And then just playing in Little League at the same time.
And did you play through Little League all the way up?
Yeah, I played till I guess I was about 16. Little League, and then Babe Ruth League is what we had. And then, you know, I was thinking about that the other day. I wanted to keep playing. What was interesting was I think after that it was American Legion ball, and I would have had to drive to different stadiums around the county, and we were like a one-car family. My dad worked shift work, and so I kind of left it at that point, because I everywhere in Little League and Babe Ruth I could walk, you know, even though I walked a lot, I could still walk to the fields. And then as I got older, I really needed wheels to get to the game. So that was kind of the end of that. And I was a good ball player, but I wasn't on my high school team, so that wasn't an option either. So
everybody has a Little League story. I want you to go ahead and prop yourself up and tell me your biggest highlight, your personal highlight from playing Little League.
Oh, geez. Well, I remember just playing the season, one of my Little League years. And then I made probably my second year. I made the All-Star team, which was pretty cool. And I showed up for my first practice at Little for the All-Stars. And I remember just like the coach didn't even introduce himself. He just said, you know, everybody line up, get a bat, I'm going to pitch to you. And he started smoking these balls across the plate, you know, a lot faster than I was used to just with your peers throwing the ball. And my first swing, I hit it over the fence. I had never hit a home run in game to game. I'm sure I know I hit some triples, but I never hit it over the fence. My first pitch practice All-Stars from the coach, I hit it over the fence, and I think my jaw just like dropped. You know, I was just like, I can't believe that just happened. So,
but it was in practice.
It was in practice, yeah. Yeah, and I wasn't contributing really to any of it. I just personally amazed that I hit it over the fence.
So your practice, you set the bar really high, and then you never got back up to that bar? Did you ever hit a home run in a game?
No, I don't remember hitting a home run.
All you did was set everybody up for disappointment, Kevin.
Yeah.
Well, we all did that too in Little League. When you're around that age, 12 to 16 to 18, what are you following Major League Baseball? Are you fans of any team at this point?
At that point, I would go to the Phillies games, but I would watch on TV, and I guess it was pretty random back then as far as what games were televised. I would watch the Cincinnati Reds because I was a catcher, and Johnny Bench was my hero. And you know, I'd buy Sports Illustrated magazine, there'd be fold outs of Johnny Bench and, you know, crouching behind the plate, you know, with his one arm behind his back and the mitt there. And so I really liked the Reds. And plus, you know, Pete Rose was there, and Tony Perez, Joe Morgan, all those guys were just amazing to watch.
So that puts you in the age group of being just a little bit older than me. So I'm going to guess you're in your early 50s?
No, I'm in the early 60s.
Oh.
61. Yeah, 61.
61 and still playing vintage baseball in Florida. That's impressive. All.
Yeah, well, I'm not in the outfield. Chasing down those monster shots, but yeah, I pitch and I'll play the infield.
I missed the Johnny Bench era growing up. The only thing I remember from Johnny Bench when I was a kid was he did a lot of spray paint commercials. And I remember him sitting on a bench. And I can't for the life of me remember the name of the spray paint. But he did so many commercials for them. It's crazy. I don't even...
Yeah, that's, I remember that now. Yeah, I don't remember the brand, but yeah, that's funny.
It's like it's right on the tip of my tongue. I can see the label. It's got like three. Is it like Krylon or oh, jeez, it's there. I think it starts with a K. Anyway, it'll take me. I'm only on my first cup of coffee. It would take me 7 hours to figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. They, I think after I went off to college, I sort of, there's too much going on. I didn't really pay attention to baseball too much when I was in college. I know when I was in grad school up in Milwaukee, around 82, I guess, the Brewers won the World Series, and I was in town for that. That was, and I went to some Brewers games there at the County Stadium, I think it was called. So that's probably when I got sort of touched back into a little bit of baseball, was when I was in grad school.
Those are some fun baseball names, that Brewers team. I think if I'm in the right era, isn't that like Robin Yount and Paul Molitor? And
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Ben Ogilvy. That was another one.
Ogilvy.
So how was that County Stadium?
Well, it was an older facility. I mean, I was probably comparing it to like Veterans Stadium or when I was there, just because that was such a modern stadium versus County Stadium. I think County Stadium still had like the iron girders, you know, exposed, holding up the upper decks and everything. So, but still, it had like a small town feel to it.
Yeah, on TV, County Stadium did not look the best.
And the Packers played a couple games there too. I think they would come down and play a couple of their home games in Milwaukee, and I remember very naively thinking, "Oh, I'll be in Milwaukee. I'll get tickets to a Packers game." And then I learned that, you know, they were handed down from generation to generation, those tickets. So I could see the Brewers, but I couldn't see the Packers.
So when you're done playing baseball, you don't play anything in college, right? That's the impression I'm getting.
That's correct. Yeah.
So as far as your personal playing, does that stop all the way up until vintage baseball, or did you get involved in softball and stuff like that?
I played a little bit of softball when I was working. I was out in Casper, Wyoming, and most of the guys, we were all still 20-somethings, and they had a softball club, and I played a little bit with those guys. And then I remember transferring out to Los Angeles, and there was a lot of young people out there playing softball. I played some softball there. So yeah, I played some softball on and off as I moved around. And then when I was overseas, I coached Little League. Like, my son was, one of my boys was little league age. One was in T-ball and one was in machine pitch. So I coached little league when I was overseas. So I didn't play anymore after those softball episodes in Casper and Los Angeles. But then kept my fingers in baseball by coaching a little bit.
Where were you overseas that you were coaching Little League?
I was in Bangkok, Thailand.
Oh, geez. So this is good stuff right here. Tell me what it was like to coach Little League baseball in a country where baseball is very important.
Yeah. It still amazes me. Like, our kids went to it was called International School Bangkok. It was American curriculum school. And they went, that school went all the way from the campus, from kindergarten up through 12th grade. So there was the elementary school, middle school, and the high school all on the same property. And they had a really nice baseball field there. And so they had the whole Little League experience for the young kids, and then the high school kids played high school ball there. And they'd have a big first, like Little League, just like in the States, opening day, you know, big deal. The actually, the U.S. Embassy would supply the hot dogs, like real hot dogs, which was kind of a treat. And you'd play. So what was really neat about it was, you know, International School Bangkok was filled with kids from all over the world. And you didn't have to be at International School Bangkok to play Little League. They were just using the school's facilities. So I had two brothers on my team from the Netherlands. I had a Russian fellow on my team. I had about three or four Japanese kids, and their brothers or their moms would come and translate, like at practice and during the games. Plus American kids and British kids and a couple Thai kids. So I had like an international team.
So
for machine pitch.
In the beginning, in the beginning, that must have been quite the transition, dealing with all of these interpreters and different cultures, and you probably didn't know how to act. You were probably scared.
I guess in some ways it was a lot of fun. And like the first time we got together, the Japanese kids already had like their big brothers with them or their moms. And so they were like, from day one, they were already able to communicate. So I didn't even have to ask, how are we going to translate for these kids? They just kind of came with their translators. So I didn't really have to deal with that. It just took care of itself. And we just got on with playing baseball. So after that, I'd say, you know, the kids, like I'd have the kids come over to the where I live a couple times, and we'd watch little videos on baseball. And so they'd have a good time all sitting together eating pizza and watching videos. And then on game day, they, after practices, you know, they were all kind of used to being around each other. So I really just had to concentrate on trying to, you know, teach them the game as much as I could.
So are there any instances when you're coaching Little League Baseball over in Bangkok, China, where you're teaching them American baseball, and then you realize that the game is a little bit different and you had to reel it back in and go in a different direction? Did you run across any of that?
You know, at that age, I didn't. I think they were, you know, they hadn't had much experience prior to that playing the game, or they hadn't been playing long enough in other leagues or in other age groups that it would make much difference to them. And then culturally, I don't think they were going to challenge me as far as what I was teaching them. I never had an instance where I thought, they learned how to swing the bat differently, or they learned how to field shortstop differently. I don't think they were developed far enough for me to see that. And then culturally, I don't think they would have put up much of a stink if they saw something that was a little bit different.
Did they have any professional baseball going on in Bangkok?
Not that I recall. Although we did, I don't recall professional baseball. They did have a world college, kind of an Olympic level world series come to Bangkok when we were there. I remember we went and saw like China play Thailand, like something along those lines. So they were Olympic equivalent teams, and I think it was a separate world event that was being held in. So it was still amateur, but I don't recall any professional baseball in Thailand.
You know, I was looking, I got the roster from the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers in front of me. There are some really crazy names on this. Raleigh Fingers was on that club. Yeah. Something I didn't remember was Don Sutton was on that club. I remember Don Sutton as a pitcher, and I remember him being on the Angels. I do not remember the Brewers. Ted Simmons was the catcher. Cecil Cooper, God, I remember his batting stance. He was all leaned over. It was crazy, like kind of like Rod Carew. And Gorman Thomas. Do you remember Gorman Thomas?
I don't.
He had a lot of facial hair. He just looked rough and rugged, and was a power hitter, of course. And when I was young collecting baseball cards, I always wanted Gorman Thomas's because he just looked like he was going to jump off the card and whoop my ass.
He's fit in today. A lot of facial hair out there today.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, did you collect any baseball cards as a kid?
I did. I wasn't like a – I didn't have – I know I had a box. I had a shoebox that we traded with. You know, you played those games where you lay down your cards and you would trade and play. And so that shoebox didn't matter what I lost or won in a game. And then I had a few cards on the side that I'd keep, but I was never really a aficionado or, you know, but certainly you're always looking for rookie cards or things when you opened up the deck. But, and then as I got older, you know, you have that collection and you look at it and you go, what am I going to keep? I never got to the point where I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to keep these cards. My brother, my older brother, he's definitely a collector. And I don't know what good cards he's got, but I know he's got some good ones that he's kept aside. And when I was out in Los Angeles, I watched the Dodgers a lot. So that was in the late 80s, early 90s. And they had a whole series of pins, lapel pins they came out with every season. And I collected all those kinds of things. But I since have given all that to my brother because he's more of a collector.
So you didn't have a baseball card that you hid from all the other kids. Like, I'll trade them anything. I don't care, except this one. You didn't.
Yeah, I probably did. But then at some point I probably traded them. So I just didn't seem to have as brilliant a collection as worth keeping. So,
you know, as we talk to you, there's so many stories from all these different places. Please tell me and everybody else who's listening, why were you in so many different places?
Well, my professional background, my education is in geology. So I'm a geologist. So after I finished grad school, I got a job in the oil and gas industry. I was with Unocal. Unocal is a 76 meatball. They used to be big sponsors of NASCAR racing. You still see the meatball with the 76 on it. That was a company I started out off working for out in the Rocky Mountains. And then that took me to Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, I joined the international division. And so from there, I started some overseas assignments. So I was mostly an exploration geologist looking for oil and gas. And then that took me to London for a couple of years, working the UK sector, the North Sea, offshore. And then I came back to the States, to Houston. That was my first tour in Houston back in the mid-90s. I was there for a while, and then Then I went to Bangkok, where we talked about the coaching baseball in Bangkok. Went to Bangkok and then came back to Houston from there and pretty much stayed in Houston until I retired in 2016.
And then you made it to the retirement capital of the United States, Florida.
Did you
ever think about Arizona? That's the other one.
Well, my wife, Allison, she's actually from Grand Blanc, Michigan. Her parents, when they retired, they eventually made their way down to Arizona, to Green Valley, south of Tucson. So we've been out there, you know, a lot, but no, it never really hit us as, yeah, let's retire here, because the summers there are almost to us. We could stand the 90s in humidity, but 100 plus and in the summer there is almost like, we didn't like the idea of the summers out there. So, no, we didn't think too long about Arizona.
On your Facebook page, if you go to Kevin Doyle's Facebook page, your cover photo is you in a sleigh with a reindeer looking over your shoulder. Explain this picture.
Yeah. I got, what was it, 2018? We went to Finland. I have a cousin who, she's kind of the reason we're in Florida. She discovered Florida back in the 90s and a property down here and became a snowbird, you know, spending part of the time down here and part of the time up in the Philly area. And so she started to invite us down. We'd bring the boys down on summer vacation for a week or so, not every year, but she's the one who kind of turned us on to Florida. And her and her husband aren't like world travelers. They're really hesitant about traveling. So they've asked us if we could go to a couple international trips together, and we're like, yeah, sure. So she wanted to see the Northern Lights, which so that's why we went off to Finland to the south. We were up in Lapland there for a couple of days, and it's funny, they had snow, but not as much snow as they typically have. It was in December, we just went on one of these reindeer sleigh ride through the woods, which is pretty cool. I mean, it's kind of like, well, it kind of looks hokey, but once you get there, the reindeer, they're just so cool. So it was fun. Yeah, so that's the picture. Yeah, so on our sleigh with the reindeer.
Wow, you have been to some great places. I also found a picture from November of 2012 of the Worldwide Highland Brigade and Scottish Division. It looks like an army of kilts. Explain this picture.
Yeah. Well, I guess back in the, I've always been a history buff and a military history buff. And back in the, when I lived in Casper, Wyoming, I was part of a reenactment group for the Civil War. And I continued that hobby when I was out in Houston for the first time. So I've always been into reenacting mostly American Civil War. And sort of gave that up in the mid-90s because I was traveling overseas. But then there was a group that got together in New Orleans for the anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans every January. And I joined that group. And so we'd get together in January to commemorate the Battle of New Orleans. But then every 5 years, they'd have over in Belgium, they'd have a reenactment of the Battle of Waterloo. So I went over in 2005. I don't know if that's that picture, but I went over in 2005. One of my boys went with me. He was just still in middle school, but it's the kilts. It was all these guys, reenactors from all over the world, got together for the Battle of Waterloo. It formed a Highland Brigade, so probably 100-150 guys and gals representing the Highland regiments that were at Waterloo in 1815. So that was a lot of fun.
You've been so many places. Can you remember one of your craziest nights in a foreign country that just went away? You weren't expecting it in some way, shape, or form. Maybe you got to the pub and things went a different way. Your nickname is Irish. So
yeah, my nickname is Irish. I do remember. It's probably being in Shanghai, China, with a group of guys. We're on business. I had been there a couple times, and our hotel was where we used to stay. This was in the old part of Shanghai. Like, you know, if you look at the history of Shanghai, a lot of countries like United States, England, France, all had a piece of Shanghai, the international quarters. You know, basically people live there and they built their houses and businesses to look like where they came from. So if you went to old Shanghai, you think you were in Europe almost. So that's kind of where our hotel was. And there was an English pub down in amongst the streets there. And I had been there a couple times. And this was all before Google Maps and GPS and all that good stuff. And I saw it, you know, you just basically, if you had a map, it was a paper map. But I had been to this pub a couple times. And then a bunch of guys came into town who had never been to Shanghai and had never been to this pub, obviously. So off we went. And I think we took cabs to the pub. And then afterwards, they all came piling out of the pub onto the street. And it was like late, and I really can't find a cab because the streets are almost deserted. But I knew my way back somehow to the hotel. I just knew all the landmarks. And, you know, I could get to the end of the street and I'd see a building that I recognized, and I'd turn left and I'd go down another street and I'd see another building, then I'd turn right and I just guided everybody back to the hotel, no problem. I was so proud of myself. So I turned out, I looked pretty good in that story. I got everybody back to the hotel, and it was a labyrinth of alleyways and streets and old Shanghai. It's an amazing place. It was then. I think since then they tore a lot down to modernize Shanghai, but that was I would never forget that story. That was pretty cool.
Is there a place that you've gone to? I have a feeling you have an answer to this. You've been to, we've talked about, you've been in Bangkok, you've been in Finland, you've been to some great places. Is there a place that you haven't brought up yet in a story that you've visited?
I'm very fortunate. I mean, my career took me to a lot of places, and then just, you know, my wife and I just having the desire to and the ability to travel, we've gone to places that I didn't get to on business. So, you know, that's been a blessing. It's been, you know, very appreciative of that opportunity to do that. There's certainly chunks of the world that I haven't been to. I haven't really spent any time in the Middle East, but there's some places there I wouldn't mind going to. But as far as interesting stories from some of the places, you know, I know that I took a trip down to Chile when I was working in Los Angeles. It was almost like an expedition down to the Chilean government that had actually been under military rule with Pinochet for like 16 years. And when the Congress of Chile got back together in somewhere around 1989-90, they opened up the country to investment. And so foreign companies could come in and look around and join with Chilean companies and do some business. So we went down there for that purpose, for oil and gas, and met with the Chilean National Oil Company and their geologists. And they took us out into the Patagonia to, as geologists, you know, one of the things we do, one of the attractions of being a geologist is going into the field and actually standing there next to the rock and sampling the rock and being outside, being outdoors. And so I was on this, effectively an expedition with these Chilean geologists. They were showing off their country in many ways to us. But we went all around Patagonia, down along the Straits of Magellan, up into Patagonia, sampling the rocks and taking in the culture and everything. There was a little chalet, real small little place where the mountain climbers would come to climb the Torres del Paine, the big mountains down in that southern part of Chile. So that was an experience. That was like my first big overseas assignment as a young geologist, and I'll never forget that. It was brilliant to do something like that.
So you're a geologist and you deal in the oil business, or you did until you happily retired. When I hear that, I think of the movie There Will Be Blood. Are you familiar with this movie?
No.
Are you familiar with the actor Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yeah.
Okay, he did a movie. You're going to want to watch this movie, Kevin. But there will be, it's a long movie. You have to invest yourself. But it's about, basically is an oil guy way back when. I don't want to give you the years but in the beginning. And he would travel around looking for where the oil is, and it actually shows how he got started and digging the holes, how they dug the holes and all this stuff back then. But basically the whole movie's about oil and how he's this oil baron and his big plans of a pipeline and all this stuff. But I promise you, you will not be disappointed with this movie.
All right, I'll give it a go.
Definitely will find that interesting. Do you know, a guy who does as much traveling and is a geologist, you probably don't watch a lot of television.
No, I don't. I never. Well, you know, there's always a show that comes along that you kind of like. But I never really, I mean, certainly as a kid, I watched a lot of television. I still remember all those goofy commercials from when I was a kid. But no, I don't, it's probably selective, I guess, as far as what I watch on TV.
But you do watch the occasional Miami Marlins game. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I'd say now, at my age now, I watch more sports than programs like weekly programs and things like that, or news or anything like that. So definitely baseball, football.
So you are interested in lacrosse and you do watch that. If you could explain to people that have never had any exposure to lacrosse before, if you could explain to them in 30 seconds what lacrosse is, go.
Lacrosse is a cross between most of the sports of soccer and hockey, played on a grass field, size of a football field, with a stick with a basket on, small basket on the end, and a really hard rubber ball. And the idea is to throw that rubber ball into a net at the end of the field, and a lot of running, a lot of checking, like in hockey, running like in soccer, passing the ball, and high speed shots, almost like slap shots in hockey.
It's a very intense game, of which it's much more physical than, say, basketball. I mean, it's a very physical sport. Am I correct?
Yeah, I never played it. Actually, when I was growing up, women's lacrosse was the thing. Like the high schools, junior grades had, middle school had women's lacrosse. Men's lacrosse, really, in the greater Philadelphia area, at least that I recall, it wasn't a sport you could play as a guy. But along the way, I was fascinated by it. And it is, if you watch it live, it is even more intense than watching it on TV. Certainly you can't use that stick unbridled. I mean, there's rules, but still you can do some whacking with that stick to try to jar that ball loose as a guy's running. So it's intense for sure.
Hey, you teach online for Wichita State, and is that geology that you're teaching?
That's correct. It's petroleum, because that's my background. I'm teaching petroleum related geology class.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you, if it was oil business related.
Yes.
Could you teach a class online that was geology, not oil based?
I could. It's I guess any teacher would tell you it takes preparation. You have to design the course and build the material.
Sure. But you've retained most of that before oil?
I would definitely I think the more an expert you are in it, like if you're a geochemist, it's chemistry, but it's applied to geology. So really you do need to have almost be a chemist to teach geochemistry. That has to almost be what you spent your career doing. So I wouldn't take on a geochemistry class because I wouldn't consider myself a chemist, even though I had plenty of chemistry in college, but there's other subdisciplines of geology that I would take on. So I'd be selective in what I would teach, other than so as far as retaining it, even in petroleum, there's certain topics that petroleum geology is almost a hybrid. It uses all different parts of geology. So there's certain sub-disciplines in geology that I'd be comfortable teaching. It just takes some time to put it all together.
Yeah. Yep. Going to end this with a current events baseball question. I just want your opinion. They came out with a suggestion of the National League teams, they don't have the designated hitter. They're talking about how in the American League, let me get my facts straight. When the National League teams, which one is it? Dang, I got to pull it up. You're going to lose I believe that you lose in the American League, you're going to lose the designated hitter when your starting pitcher leaves the game. I believe that's how that's going to work. And I might have that completely opposite. So I'm going to look it up. Look it up here quick. But league still discussing universal DH. I should have read more about it before I.
The one that I like was having a designated hitter, for the pitchers, versus the pitcher basically getting up there and wasting an at bat unless pitcher's really good hitter, which a few of them are. But I just like the idea of of there being a designated hitter in both leagues. This one that you're describing now is a variation on the theme, and I hadn't actually heard about that.
Yeah, that's what it is. Is when your starting pitcher is in the game, he's the hitter. When your starting pitcher leaves the game, it's a DH spot.
So,
because relief pitchers, they're even worse at hitting than starting pitchers.
Yeah, I get it.
But that's just one proposal. That's not what's happening. I think the last I heard about the DH for this season is they're going universal with DH for the entire season.
I know the purists really are up in arms about that, but it just seems, for a guy to stand up there and whiff, or get beamed and hit and, break up wrist or something, given the amount of money that the game requires for these guys, it just seems a risk that's not worth taking in the modern era. So that's just my feeling about it.
And back, it used to be where when you played baseball, you played everywhere. And now it is a much more specialized situation. If you're a pitcher and you're a good pitcher, you're pitching. You're not getting batting practice.
that's true. There's no time for those guys to have batting practice. That'd be on your own time. So that's a really important one. They're not even the proper practice time for a pitcher, even if he wants to bat.
All right, Kevin, we're going to end this on giving you the old pepper. These are random questions. Just give a quick answer to them.
Okay.
Orange juice, pulp or no pulp?
Pulp.
Who's your favorite Major League Baseball player of all time? It's Johnny Bench. We've already discussed that.
Johnny Bench. Did I mention Johnny Bench?
What was that?
Did I mention Johnny Bench?
Yeah, you did. what was your first car?
Toyota Celica hatchback, 1977.
What was your favorite restaurant in Houston?
There was a German restaurant in Houston. Rudy's that I really enjoyed.
You've been in Florida for a few years now, so have you made it to Disney?
I made it to Disney once since being here. I had been there prior with when my boys were growing up a couple times.
Okay,
family.
So the question is, name an overrated Disney attraction.
Well, right now, I think where all the international pavilions are.
Epcot.
Epcot. Yeah, I used to love Epcot, and I was really, really disappointed with Epcot this last time. That was a bummer.
Name a chore you hate to do.
Wash floors.
What's your favorite? What's your favorite baseball movie?
Bad News Bears.
What was your first pet?
Goldfish.
What is the worst injury you've suffered?
Injury. A groin strain.
Ooh. What was one of your favorite Halloween costumes you've ever wore?
I think like a commando army guy.
When you're in Florida in the summer and you walk outside, how many seconds until you sweat?
About two.
From food. food from all over the world that you've experienced, what is your Mount Rushmore of food?
Food? Mount Rushmore of food?
Of places,
yeah,
cultures that you've experienced, what is your Mount Rushmore?
I would say Thailand, Bangkok, Thailand, Thai food.
Need three more.
Does that make sense?
Is Bangkok and Thailand together?
Bangkok, capital of Thailand.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a pretty cosmopolitan place.
Okay, that's one. I need three more countries that have good food. It's the Mount Rushmore.
Oh, it's the Mount Rushmore, sorry. So yeah, Thailand, and it might sound funny, but Ireland used to be just meat and potatoes, but once they joined the European Union, they really, like, you know, some great chefs, great food going on in Ireland and the pubs. And then the other one, when I was in Chile, the stews, the meat stews that you have in Chile, and yeah, like that.
Jeez, we didn't even talk about Ireland. Name something you're afraid of.
I don't like snakes that much, but I've come a long way with snakes. It used to just freak me out. Now I can handle it.
What was your favorite cereal as a kid?
Captain Crunch.
Oh, God, that's tough on the mouth. Captain Crunch will tear up your face.
there's part of your mouth though. It's too late. You've already chomped down on it. You're like out.
And the last question is, if you could be stuck on any age of your life that you've experienced up until now, what age would that be?
What age? Jeez, at least. I'd probably say 30-something, mid-30s.
All right, I think we've done it, Kevin. You guys are practicing right now, yeah?
Well, we had a game in October, and then we had a game just last weekend here. The guys from the Awkwards came down from Central Florida, so we played. And then we have a match coming up February 7th up in Kissimmee, and a match February 28th up in Orlando. And then we've got our tournament, a big tournament here in Fort Myers, the Edison Ford sponsored tournament in March. That's the big one. We're trying to get a third team to come down. Last year it was canceled because of the pandemic.
Sure.
We got two teams, the Akron Black Stockings and the Chicago Salmons. We're looking for a third team.
All right.
Tournament. Or a composite of fellas, people, guys and gals are down here vacationing. They could warm up in, you know, a third.
Yeah, so, how hard could it be to find nine guys that want to go to Florida? It could, you know, it might be a barnstorming team, but it's still, it could happen.
it has, you know, happened previously. The pandemic's really thrown up monkey wrench into everything, but we're still hopeful we'll get the third team.
All right, Kevin. Well, hey, I really appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, Matt, thank you for inviting me. That was quite a surprise to get your message, and it's been fun.
It's you have lived a life, my friend. You have lived a life.
Yeah, good.
So stay on the line for me. Don't hang up. As I say goodbye to everybody, and everybody out there listening to the Roller Around the Barrel podcast, I do have a couple of more episodes scheduled in the very near future, so hang in there. We'll be pumping those out. Once again, thanks to Kevin, thanks to the listeners, and we'll catch you on the other side. Thanks, guys.